It's time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Stephen Thompson. On this week's show, we discuss the Netflix original series Wet Hot American Summer, its many famous stars and guest stars, the cult 2001 movie that spawned it, and the curious resurrection of a very unlikely franchise. Then we'll tackle a far likelier franchise by talking about Mission Impossible Rogue Nation, the fifth entry in a wildly successful series of Tom Cruise movies. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. We'll be right back, so stick around.
Hello, Pop Culture Happy Hour listeners. Hey, why don't you try out NPR's Planet Money? It's full of funny, insightful stories about how the world works, like why we work so much, plus useful stuff like the messed up economics of drought and the psychology of a big red button. Find Planet Money now at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
Before we get things started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Chris Klimek, tell us about yourself, won't you?
I write about air and space for Smithsonian Air and Space, and I review generally loud movies for NPR.
And patched in from her outpost at NPR West, we have a very special guest this week. Linda Holmes, what do you do at NPR?
Well, I write the blog Monkey See, and very often I host a podcast called Pop Culture Happy Hour.
Yeah, only like 235 or 240 of them. Mm-hmm. So,
yes, that's correct.
But before we get going on our topics this week, we do have a crucial correction from last week's episode.
Yeah, last week there was a discussion between Bob Mondello and Ari Shapiro about whether or not Audrey Hepburn sang Moon River in Breakfast at Tiffany's, which, mm-hmm. of course, she did. Ari was right. Bob was very, very wrong.
And Bob was really sure.
Really wrong. This is the chance. If I was here, I would have backed up Ari, but that's the problem. You guys were playing with fire with only having two gay men in a
right.
room. You always want to have three.
My
you
Fair Lady, right?
Is that what this is about? Break the tie. That's just science.
Yeah. Well, and the thing was, Ari was so sad at that information that I'm happy to be able to make him feel better now that it really was her. I definitely took no position on that, but did not know, so we're glad to have that cleared up.
All right. So last Friday, Netflix dropped all 8 episodes of a series it's calling Wet Hot American Summer.
Rogue Nation.
Rogue Nation. The Legend of Curly's Gold. Mm. No, Wet Hot American Summer, First Day of Camp. It's actually a prequel to the 2001 movie Wet Hot American Summer, and like that film, it comes from the comedy team of Michael Showalter and David Wayne, who worked on The State and Reno 911 and projects like that. Now, the original Wet Hot American Summer essentially satirizes every summer camp teen comedy ever made, and it's fair to say, as I recall from being alive at that time, that film did not do well commercially.
It grossed $300,000.
$300,000. It was also not well-liked by critics. There is a famous Roger Ebert one-star
yes.
review that has been making the rounds yet again. But the film also starred a bunch of what would become big names. In addition to Janine Garofalo, it's got Paul Rudd, Amy Poehler, Bradley Cooper, Elizabeth Banks, David Hyde Pierce, and a ton of other character actors and comics. And the Netflix series brings back basically everybody, except that everyone is, of course, 14 years older than they already were when they were 20-somethings playing teenagers. The TV show is set even earlier in the summer of 1981 when the movie is set. Glenn, have I even begun to summarize what is going on?
A lot happens. You know, somebody online was saying that they couldn't believe that they decided to do a series to give themselves all that much more time when the script, the screenplay for Wet Hot American Summer was so tight. And I remember thinking to myself...
Sorry. Didn't mean to step on what you were saying.
We did not see the same movie because that is the loosest, shaggiest 90 minutes ever committed to film. And this series is basically that. It feels like a true extension because, like the movie, it's loose, it's shaggy, it is episodic. If you remember, I just watched the movie before seeing the series. It doesn't have plots so much that weave in and out threads, an A plot, a B plot, a C plot. It has a joke A and a joke B and a joke C. It feels very chunky, very episodic.
Yeah, so here's a thing that happens. Here's another thing that happens.
Exactly. And but man, the tone of this, and in fact, there's like 16 different tones. There's 12 different tones. Schoenberg, because it's all these different tones. Whatever the joke is what the tone adopts. What tone the movie and the show adopts, and then it switches to another one. But that is a tone. That sensibility, at least, is something I want to kind of crawl inside and live in forever for the rest of my days.
So you're a fan of the movie and of the show?
Of both, yeah. Because of all these tones, it's not just parody that they're doing. I mean, Wayne and Showalter are constantly saying when they're interviewed that they're not so much parodying Meatballs and Little Darlings and other camp movies. Mm-hmm. They're taking their comedic sensibility and applying it to the camp experiences they had as kids. And their comedic sensibility, we used to call alt comedy back in 2001. Now I think we just call it comedy because this is where comedy has come. The sensibility is to have a setup, a very familiar setup, because the familiarity of the setup of your joke is part of the humor. And then instead of a punchline, you basically proceed to dismantle the setup methodically. And that's where this humor comes from. And I dug it.
All right. Chris Klimek, your thoughts on Wet Hot American Summer, the movie and the TV show?
It took me a long time to see the movie. I saw it once. I enjoyed it very much. I can't quote it chapter and verse the way I can other David Wayne properties like Role Models. So I had to jump in kind of late here. I just got back into town last night. I was trying to watch these on Amtrak where the Wi-Fi is spotty, but I got through the first four.
Now did you jump into the movie this late? Or?
I didn't. No, I saw the movie a few years ago, but okay. I mean some years after 2001 when it came out.
Okay.
And they're just super fun. I feel like this is the only place that Bradley Cooper's career could possibly go after American Sniper. You know,
he basically hasn't aged a day.
No. Actually, the only person who is not just as attractive as they were in 2001 is Michael Showalter.
Yeah.
Got to say, he's the only one who looks like he's aged.
He's aged like a normal person.
And they have fun with that.
But it's great. It's so much fun. This is the kind of thing that makes being a comic look like fun. It's like the anti-Louis or sort of the anti-The Comedians, which was the last time I talked about a comedy show on this podcast, where I feel like that, that gets so much closer to the loneliness and self-loathing
That's
side
the
of
the Josh Gad and Billy Crystal.
Yes, FX series. None of these people are known primarily for stand-up. They're mostly, ensemble, like sketch-based comedic actors.
Yeah, they're UCB people.
Right. But it's very improv-based kind of sensibility. And, I don't have a sophisticated take. It's just seen the first half, and I'll probably go through the rest tonight. Really fun.
All right, so I'm staring at two grinning comedy goons. The opinion I'm really curious about is that of one Linda Holmes.
I mean, I certainly had seen it years ago. Not originally. I can't claim that any of those $300,000 were mine, but I had seen it, years ago. I have certainly friends who were fans of it who eventually kind of convinced me to watch it. And I thought it was funny. I'm very much like Chris. I can't quote it chapter and verse. It's not a go-to for me, but I definitely liked it and thought it was funny. The risk with a TV show like this, of course, is that it's going to be too arch, right? It's going to be too, it's going to have an ironic distance that's kind of so parody of a parody and so kind of impressed with its own
parody of a thing that's already silly.
Exactly. There is a tone that could easily develop in something like this that I would not be into, that would kind of be smug, inside comedy kind of stuff that I don't always like. But I think for the most part, they do stay away from that. And one of the things that I like about the episodes that I've seen, and I, like Chris, I've been struggling with terrible Wi-Fi out here in California. They don't have Wi-Fi. I'm just kidding. No.
not a very wired place.
Where I have been staying, the Wi-Fi has been pretty questionable. So I've only seen three of these, and I will watch the rest. What I like about the ones that I've seen is that they do kind of acknowledge as almost an extra level of comedy the silliness of the fact that 14 years later, as you say, 14 years after they played teenagers as 20-somethings, they're now even older. And right. I think the leaning into Michael Showalter's wig is kind of the way of taking a step back and saying, like, everybody understands that this is very much a skit type of thing,
yeah,
as opposed to being just like a straight up comedy. I think the fact that they're acknowledging how bad his wig is and they're acknowledging, again, it is sort of funny to see that, like, Paul Rudd looks the same, if not better,
exactly
because
the same.
because he never ages.
Yeah.
As has been well established in Vulture and a lovely quiz you should take. I think they get to the right tone. I do think it's funny. This is another one that I prefer not to binge watch because the comedy effect wears off.
Exactly.
A little bit. If you watch eight of them back to back, for me, it would fade a little bit.
Sure.
So I do prefer to watch them, dole them out a little bit at a time. I'm always like that with comedy. I said the same thing about BoJack Horseman. Mm-hmm. I prefer not to binge watch silly comedy.
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring up serialized comedy and the format of this show, which is obviously it's different from a movie. And I just watched the movie for the first time yesterday.
Good Lord.
You know, it came out in 2001. It was the year that my son was born. And so I just never saw it. And I'm not a big basic cable channel flipper. And if you watch basic cable for particularly what Comedy Central for a period of about a decade, this was like all you saw. I just never got around to seeing this movie. And one of the feelings that I had watching the movie and the TV show very close together, back to back to back, is that these are TV people who struggle with the long form way of making this project. The movie for me has a bunch of like really nice little moments. It's fun. I can see it growing on me. I could see being exposed to it multiple times and having it kind of get under my skin as a thing that I like. Yeah. But because I didn't have that experience, I'm watching it like, this? Really?
Huh.
And I think part of the difference between the movie, I mean, it's a big difference between the movie and the show, is the show, they're 28-minute bites. And these are people who are really good at making 28-minute bites, as opposed to a 96-minute movie, which feels very flabby.
I hope I'm proven wrong about this, but I'm not so excited about Key and Peele making movies, because I love the sketches so much. You know, I want 100 more seasons of Key and Peele, the sketch show.
Well, and I've seen every episode of Mr. Show, which we've talked about a bunch of times. I've also seen Run, Ronnie, Run, the Mr. Show movie, which is another thing that like has its moments, but is largely unsuccessful.
This is another nice thing about the proliferation of outlets, right? That
people
like this, who at one time had to choose between television, which meant a very, very limited number of places to go and a very limited number of sensibilities, and meant fitting yourself into somebody's schedule and all that stuff, now have more of an opportunity to experiment with more outlets. They can kind of come and go. People's contracts and lives allow different kinds of shooting and different kinds of whatever. So it allows people to work closer to what their natural style and pace is. And I agree with you that I think the pace of this is much more the pace that these people ideally work in, much more than in movies. And the other thing that I would say is that I think they do a good job of staying out of one of the things that created so much trouble for the additional Netflix season of Arrested Development, which is that in Arrested Development, in that bonus season, to me, it just was so obvious that the scheduling had been so complicated that you didn't see people together. You saw a couple people at a time when they could get people to shoot. It certainly appeared that way to me.
Sure, me too.
And whereas in this, you really do get that big ensemble, at times at least. In the times when they are working with smaller groups of people, it's much more seamless. And I think there are moments when you say, yeah, you know, Bradley Cooper disappears for large, at least in these early episodes, disappears for long periods of time in a way that Showalter doesn't and Zach Orth doesn't and some of that stuff.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I think they work very gracefully around whatever the difficulties were of getting this cast together.
Yeah, I felt that much, much, much less with this. It really felt like they got all these incredibly famous people and actually just sent them off to summer camp.
And the people who were not part of the movie originally, they I mean, even though John Hamm is playing a character who's deliberately removed from the rest of them.
Sure. And there are a lot of these guest stars.
Yeah. I mean, they still feel like they're all part of the team. You know, they don't seem elevated or anything.
But what the... I'm going to defend the kind of roominess of this show, the extra space we get, because every scene has... Like the popped collars on Josh Charles.
I was just three layers. Say, the tri-popped collars. Can three we layers. Talk about the tri-popped collars?
You got the tri-popped collars. You have the actual emotion of the scene that they're playing. Then we have a meta experience because we recognize it's these actors that we know and we feel like we know from outside. So the fact that they're doing it is a second layer. But they're all so committed to it and to heightening it in not just a parodic way, but heightening it so that it brings it back around to this weird sincerity. Mm-hmm. Every scene between Bradley Cooper and Michael Ian Black was funny and sweet and kind of sweet, surprisingly so, because I think that Michael Ian Black was playing it on more layers than, say, Bradley Cooper was. I mean, because Michael Ian Black is carved out of irony. Everything out of his mouth seems like he's kidding. Mm-hmm. And when he has to be sincere here, you totally buy it. I loved it.
Yeah, I think the TV show in particular is very successful for me. I've seen 6 of the 8 in addition to the movie, and it's kind of accelerating for me in a way that is really working. But I do feel overall the experience of suddenly mainlining this thing that I missed when it came out. I was hanging out over the weekend. I was at a party with a bunch of people who were about, I'd say, 30 on average. And for them, like every single one of them was like, I've seen this 30 times. Right. I've watched it on basic cable. I can't wait.
It's like Newsies.
It's like Newsies or Hocus Pocus. There is a generation. I mean, you guys, Chris and Glenn, are
exactly the same age.
You guys are 29 years old. No, you're both comedy people.
Yeah.
So it makes sense that you would have steeped in this show already. But this was one of the first signs of a point that I've brought up on this show before, which is I turned 43 over the weekend. And I, a couple years ago, mentioned that I was like squinting at the dying embers of my generation's cultural relevance. And that all these things that were very, very relevant to my like 18, 19, 20 year old self, all these things are happening in this big burst. First, kind of for the last time, before the next generation's pet things get rebooted and regenerated, and Girl Meets World is another one. I didn't watch Boy Meets World. This is the equivalent. The fact that this thing even exists is the equivalent of, like, okay, so when I was like 18, 19, 20, I was obsessed, ironically obsessed, with the movie Cool as Ice. The Vanilla Ice
vehicle, which we know what this is.
I thought I might need to explain it to the young people at home. that Cool as Ice is this absolutely hilarious movie star vehicle for the rapper Vanilla Ice that made about as much money in theaters as Wet Hot American Summer did. It's as if they got Vanilla Ice to do like an 8-episode prequel to Cool as Ice for people like me. That is how newly overserved, I think, a certain generation suddenly is. I mean, I love that it exists. This is very specialized, this particular
show. There are going to be some comedy nerds. There are going to be some kids who watched it when they were young, who hit exactly at the right place, who are going to resent some of the retconning that goes on here. We get a backstory behind the can of vegetables. Yeah. No one was clamoring for a backstory on the can of vegetables. And as soon as I started recognizing that I was feeling kind of like, why'd they even bother? I thought to myself, okay, Glenn, you're taking this more seriously than they do. So forget it. Just let it go.
I think the less they refer to the movie, the better. And it's a little, Arrested Development was a little bit like that too, where they were constantly needing to do fan service of recalling old jokes instead of just like focus on new ones. I just want more of the thing.
Well, let's go around the table. MVP of this show, anyway.
Oh, of the show. Well, I'll start with Linda.
For what I've seen so far, definitely Rudd. I just think Paul Rudd is so funny in this, and so just the way that his natural, to me, likability plays against this like super, super douchey person that he's playing, I find terribly funny. Although somebody recently told me that they find him kind of, you know, like creepy, or smarmy, I think was the word, which I never do, but I know some people do. Mm-hmm. So to me, I'm going to say Paul Rudd.
Perfectly good answer. Chris Klimek?
I'm going to go Elizabeth Banks on this one. And I think I'm a little biased towards her right now because she was so good in Love and Mercy this year. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she directed Pitch Perfect 2, and I'm kind of realizing
she's just
a really good kind of MVP all-rounder. I think I just put two sports metaphors that mean different things in the same sentence.
Her backstory, that is a backstory I am greatly enjoying.
That was great. Special mention to David Wayne as Yaron. I don't think you guys have spent a lot of time with him, but there's more of him coming. And man, that's not a character I see a lot on American screens, and I know Yaron. I've met Yaron many times. But my MVP is Christopher Maloney.
Yeah.
Not just because of the impressiveness of his body fat percentage, although that is notable, but because he's just so committed to the bit. This does not have a similar joke to me. My favorite joke in the movie is "Meet me in 10 seconds by the picnic table."
Yeah,
that is my favorite joke in the movie. There's nothing like that here that stands out. Although, coming up, the very final exchange between Jon Hamm and Janeane Garofalo.
You're not going to spoil anything.
I'm not going to spoil it, but it's in the last episode. It's one of the last things that happens, and it is it is perfect. It is so good.
I think that these are all excellent MVP candidates, and I would co-sign at least one or two of them. One of the advantages that this show has is they know what their assets are. These people are as famous as they are now, and they know, like, we got Bradley Cooper to do this. We got Amy Poehler to do this. And Bradley Cooper and Amy Poehler as a team are very, very funny and very charming, and there's this wonderful little detail in a very early episode. Bradley Cooper is, of course, we learn in the movie, and this is all prequel, is gay and falls in love with Michael Ian Black. But in the beginning of the TV show, he's learning this, and he is, quote-unquote, dating Amy Poehler. And there's this scene where he is to like lean in and tenderly kiss her forehead because and she's, you know, she's always wanting to advance the relationship and he's always holding back. And he leans in to kiss her forehead and then turns his face and kisses her forehead with the side of his lips. And it's just such a funny, goofy detail. Again, like there's so much commitment to the goof nuttery. I ultimately really enjoy the show quite a bit more, like I said, than I've enjoyed the movie.
You know, if 5.5 hours of Wet Hot American Summer between the series and the feature is not enough for you, what dropped concurrently on Netflix with the new episodes is a documentary called Hurricane of Fun, which was just assembled, I think it's 64 minutes or so, from, you know, footage taken during the 2000 production of Wet Hot American Summer. And it's really fun. You actually get, Cooper explains to you what a director does, since it was his first feature, and he mentions how he showed up on the set 2 days after graduating from college. But it's fairly equally split between these comedians kind of doing bits for the cameras and just being very, you know, earnest about how excited they are to be there. And it really sounds like the production of the movie was like summer camp and really unique. So there's more if you need more. Hurricane of Fun.
Suddenly everyone's clamoring. Yes. In 2001, we would have said no one was clamoring, but now they are. All right, I'm pretty sure that folks at home have developed some opinions of Wet Hot American Summer, and we would love to hear them, as always. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on Twitter at NPRPCHH. We will be right back.
This episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour and the following message are made possible by MeUndies. 90% of your life is spent wearing underwear, so why would you spend it in anything other than a pair of MeUndies? MeUndies fit perfectly, keep you cool, and are made from Modell, which is 2 times softer than cotton. And now they're offering 20% off your first order when you go to MeUndies.com/happyhour. If you don't love them, your first pair is free. Again, that's 20% off your first order of the world's best underwear at MeUndies.com/happyhour.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. For our next topic, we thought we'd check in with a sturdy action movie franchise, Mission Impossible, or in this case, Mission Impossible Rogue Nation. Basically, Tom Cruise leads an elite government agency of ass kickers who specialize in kicking ass as they battle their way out of scrapes that seem, as you might imagine, impossible. Now, before we begin this segment, Linda, you are not near a movie theater, are you?
Well, you know, it's not so much that movie theaters are far away as it is that I have very little free time and no car. So as much as we hate to do this, sometimes the summer scheduling does get the better of us. And in this case, I am present in this segment to listen and learn all about Mission Impossible. I will make this one small contribution. I have really enjoyed these movies. I share with, I think, some of y'all the sense that this has been a pretty good franchise, and I think a couple of them have been exceptional and certainly have exceptional set pieces. So I definitely plan to see it, but this is where I step back and listen to all you brilliant fellows chat about the Tom Cruise movie. Anyway.
All right. Well, Chris, I'm gonna go to Chris first as our resident person who comes on the show and talks about smashy. What did you think of Mission: Impossible Rogue Nation?
I loved it. Long Dash, this series has been a real director's franchise. Mm-hmm. You know, Tom Cruise produced each of these. I think his career as a producer started with the first one. So he is in a position to choose directors, maybe even more so than, you know, than most A-list stars. And he seems to have really good taste on this front. The first one was Brian De Palma, you know, the famous sort of acolyte of Hitchcock. Mm-hmm. And then for the second one, we go in a completely different direction. It's a John Woo movie. It is the John Woo-iest movie that he made while working in, you know, for American Studios.
Are there doves?
Doves are all over it. Okay. There are like 8 or 9 instances of the rubber masks coming off.
Oh, yeah.
It's totally over the top and goofy. It, you know, very loosely connected to the first one. The third one was where J.J. Abrams comes in right off of Alias. It was the first time he directed a feature. His filmmaking sensibility is very Spielbergian, so this is the closest thing we get to like a Spielberg-directed
sure.
James Bond movie, as he was, you know, apparently going to do for a while in the 80s. And then you get Brad Bird, you know,
who
transitioning, for Ghost Protocol, transitioning to live action films, but still kind of making them the way he made The Incredibles,
sure.
you know, with this really kinetic sensibility. But I think these directors are really encouraged to put their stamps on each installment. Chris McQuarrie, who is a screenwriter on Edge of Tomorrow, which we all loved, who wrote and directed Jack Reacher, who was nominated for Best Original Screenplay for The Usual Suspects 20 years ago. He's directing this movie. He doesn't have as strong a visual sensibility as the other directors, but he is really smart. He's a really good craftsman, and I think we'll talk about the set pieces in this one more in a minute, but I really loved it.
All right, Glenn?
Yeah, this franchise and this movie is a machine with no grit in the gears at all. Mm-hmm. And everything kind of felt to me like was on rails, but yeah. I didn't care. Didn't care because it serves up, you know, Simon Pegg being exasperated. Like, I'm like a rat pressing a button. Like, yes, I want more of that.
And that's the pellet that comes out.
Yes, it has Rebecca Ferguson as a femme fatale, killing dudes with her thighs. Mm-hmm. Press, press, press.
As one does.
And it front loads a lot of the things you want from this franchise. It gives you, in the first 15 minutes, it gives you that big set piece, the plane
it's
ride.
The first five minutes. Right, like, right. That's the cold open.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah, the Tom Cruise dangling from a plane is not a spoiler.
Which, it's no, but we need to say this because, like, when I'm complaining that too many movies put everything in the trailer and leave nothing, like, the fact that this entire movie's ad campaign has been built around what turns out to be the first 5 minutes of the movie is just great.
Yep.
That they save all the rest of it for you to discover.
And arguably, even more important than that to this franchise, is Tom Cruise running as he's karate chopping the air in front of him to make it part in front of him, and using Jeremy Renner, who I am on record as saying is a big bowl of bland.
Yep. Potato nose ball of bland.
Many times.
Using him as a foil gives him the illusion of having a personality, having an edge. It really works.
Poor Jeremy Renner.
This is the thing. And it also plays with giving Tom Cruise the illusion of vulnerability. Mm-hmm. Like, this character doesn't have any vulnerability. They are pushing him into an era of giving him a couple moments of acknowledging that he is aging. For a second, I am convinced that he's a human being and not a cyborg sent from planet Cyclo to pave the way for their invasion. I mean, there's nothing going on behind his eyes. There never has been, there never will be, but giving us those little moments could kind of convince you otherwise for a second.
Well, yeah, I mean, I have never really been cursed with the gene of being unable to suspend disbelief in a Tom Cruise movie. Like, I never have a problem watching Tom Cruise on the screen. I'm not automatically somehow tired of him because of his public persona.
Mm. And my friend Amy Nicholson, the film critic for LA Weekly, she wrote a book about Tom Cruise last year, and, you know, and she really laments the loss of the Tom Cruise of Magnolia and Jerry Maguire and the mid to late 90s, or Interview with the Vampire, which, you know, a performance that everybody was, including Anne Rice, was very skeptical about. And then he kind of, he proved a lot of people wrong with that one. And that, you know, in the last decade has been pretty much replaced by just the full-time action guy. You know, I think I would feel worse about that if the movies were not action films of a really, really high standard of execution.
Well, and one thing to keep in mind is Tom Cruise does not have a ton of flops in his career. He has an enormous
legend.
Number of,
legend is the only massive, actual money loser, I think.
Like, by percentage and by volume, it's a remarkable number
in
of
30 years
of hits. And I think that one thing he is probably figuring is he's got X number of years left to be a giant torsoed action star, and eventually he's going to have to figure out how to become the next phase, the Al Pacino phase, or whatever, how to be a 60-year-old and how to be a 70-year-old actor. I mean, presuming he's thinking that far ahead, he's probably getting a lot of his action movies out of the way.
Yeah, I'm content to have him do this for a while because I think I don't know if I think he's a great actor, but I think he is a great cinethete, screen athlete, something like that. I mean, we are talking like a close to Jackie Chan or Fred Astaire level physical performer. Whether or not I believe he's a human being, I kind of don't care, and I kind of like that he, as Ethan Hunt in these Mission Impossible movies, has very little personality.
Right.
I don't want more of that. You know, I like the fact that he is basically a cipher defined by the people around him. It's kind of the man with no name thing.
So you just used a word that I have written down in my notes, which is cipher. And it's not necessarily about Tom Cruise. It's actually my one fundamental underlying criticism of this series, which is, like you mentioned, like there are these very director-driven projects where the directors are really encouraged to put their stamps on it. One of the ways that that's possible is that the stories are kind of ciphers. Mm-hmm. Like this movie in particular, and I liked this film, but the story is very much like, here's a clan of tough people
who
kick ass, and they are battling something called the Syndicate, and the Syndicate is evil. it's really close plot-wise to there's a box and everyone wants the box.
Sure,
it's right. These people are bad and we want to hurt
well,
them.
Well, in Mission Impossible 3, I love this as a gag. They don't even tell you what the MacGuffin actually is. They just refer to it as the rabbit's foot throughout the movie, and you never find out what it is, which I think is a really smart joke.
I think that's also the reason why these movies tend to evaporate on contact with my eyeballs. I can tell you that in Ghost Protocol, he climbed a building and there was a dust storm, and that is it.
Right.
None of it just stays with you. But in that theater, these stunts, I get bored by chase scenes. I don't care about a chase scene. I was riveted. This was a really good motorcycle chase scene.
I had that reaction to Ghost Protocol as well. I remember, I think I described it, it might have been a different movie, but I think it was that one, as like a movie sandwich, where there was like each slice of bread was made of a movie, and then there was the meat in the middle was also another movie, and it just felt like movie on top of movie on top of movie. Like, I remember being thrilled by it, a little overwhelmed, but now I remember something about falling down a building, and that's like the extent of it.
I don't disagree with that. I think people tend to remember individual set pieces more than the films themselves.
Yep.
But really, you know, once you get more than, say, three films in a series, doesn't that kind of happen to any franchise where they do start to run together eventually?
Not necessarily, because like if you look at even as flawed a series as Die Hard, where your first Die Hard is essentially flawless, your second Die Hard's a little ridiculous, and it starts to really fly off those rails, you can differentiate them based on this is Die Hard with a plane, this is Die Hard with, you know, riding a motorcycle into a helicopter.
You're inviting my scholarly defense of Die Hard with a vengeance.
Bless your heart, Chris Klimek. Love you so much. But like, they feel very much the same plot-wise, even though they are visually different, even though the set pieces vary. The set pieces vary a lot more than the plots.
Yeah, but Chris, you were mentioning to me that this film was pushed up, I guess.
It was 5 months.
Yeah, and that's why I do think it's 10 minutes too long, and I think it would have been tightened in the editing if they'd had a few more months, as they believed that they did when it went into production.
This was supposed to be a Christmas release. Because it was ahead of schedule, they moved it to take it away from Star Wars. They're convinced that Star Wars is just going to steamroll everything.
I just associate this film in particular with summer.
Yeah, I mean, it has been traditionally a summertime franchise, although Ghost Protocol was a December release also.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think we all agree this movie's fun. Tell us what you think.
Fun.
Yeah, join us on Facebook, facebook.com/PCHH. And when we come back, we will talk about our favorite thing, namely, what is making us happy this week.
Support for this podcast and the following message comes from Hulu, presenting Difficult People, the new original comedy series from Amy Poehler. Billy Eichner and Julie Klausner star in this unapologetic story about best friends who seek fame and acceptance in the cutthroat New York comedy scene. They have no filter, no shame, and can't help but rub everyone the wrong way. TV Guide calls the show beyond laugh out loud, very funny. Catch new episodes every Wednesday, only on Hulu.
And finally, our favorite segment every week, What is Making Us Happy? Linda Holmes, take it away.
Okay, so I am in California for the Television Critics Association press tour. As I tape this, we have heard from Netflix and Amazon and a lot of unaffiliated cable like Discovery and HBO and some other stuff. We have not even started the networks yet. Your ABCs and CBSs.
And it seems like you've been out there forever.
And it seems like I've been out here forever. But there have already been some very enjoyable panels. We had some fun stuff from Netflix. We had a really nice panel from PBS about an upcoming Walt Disney American experience that they're doing. Also, for those of you who follow my history through this show, went to a little Hallmark Channel party.
Nice.
Spoke to a fellow by the name of Jack Wagner, who I've talked about before, who, when he was on General Hospital, I saw sing twice at the Valley Forge Music Fair. Aww. So I went up to him at this party and I sat down and I said, I came over here to talk to you because I saw you at the Valley Forge Music Fair. And he said, give it to me, 1985. And I said, 1985. And we had a lovely little conversation about it. He's very good at that particular function that you have to serve, which is to give the old lady a little thrill. So
did he sing All I Need?
He didn't, but he was very, very sweet. And he's actually very gracious about this kind of thing. He's clearly been through this more than once. So it was a very nice conversation. That was really fun. The panels are going well. Also, I hopped out of LA for about 36 hours to Dallas to go to a conference called Podcast Movement, which is symbolized by this like fist holding a microphone. It's kind of weird.
A little angrier than, than we are.
Yeah. But I went there to be on a panel with some folks from NPR. I was on a panel with one of the folks who works on sponsorship stuff, and also Mike Danforth and Ian Chillag, who do How to Do Everything and also work on Wait, Wait. We did a panel together. It was fun. The idea, when I said that I had left one conference to attend another conference, Ian said, that's like boredom inception, which is a little bit true. But at the same time, the one conference is good. The other conference is also good. So although in theory it is boredom inception, in practice it was okay. So what's making me happy this week is that I'm in this whirlwind of interesting, weird stuff and everything's good. And so I miss my pals back there, but what's making me happy is that eventually I shall be home.
Oh, we miss you, buddy, but we're also very glad that you are still upright.
Yeah.
Thank you, Linda Holmes. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Oh, a bunch of crap. Another Period is a show on Comedy Central, written and starring Natasha Leggero and Ricky Lindholm. It's a historical parody, basically. So it's the way they're selling it is it's the Kardashians meets Downton Abbey. I saw the first episode because it's set in the Gilded Age around Newport, Rhode Island. This family, this very wealthy family in the upstairs, downstairs, blah, blah, blah. I saw the first episode and put a pin in it, thinking I'm going to come back and look at this again. I have since seen more episodes, and it is so smart and so funny and so joke dense.
Nice.
And there's this trope that's going around now with calling something slyly feminist. There's no sly here. It's just feminist. It's just bracingly, matter-of-factly feminist. It's women-centered comedy. It's fantastic. So that's another Period. And there's also a book that I've recently started that I'm loving very much. It's called The Golem and the Genie by Helene Wecker. It's basically two creatures from Jewish folklore and Arab folklore coming together as immigrants in turn-of-the-century Manhattan. I haven't gotten them meeting yet, but the writing, this is meticulously researched by Helene Wecker. It's a debut novel. Again, I'm only just cracking the spine, but I'm loving this sentence-by-sentence experience. I'm loving this world of turn-of-the-century Manhattan that she's creating, and I'm loving the fantastical elements she's introducing as well. It seems seamless. She might screw the pooch at the end. I don't know. But it's really something I'm loving. That's The Golem and the Genie by Helene Wecker.
Thank you, Glenn Weldon. Chris Klimek, what is making you happy this week?
Well, to the extent that you can work as a theater critic for 5 or 6 years without being particularly a fan of musicals in general. I love Sweeney Todd, but not the ones that are not about cannibalism so much. I brought a clip. Jess, can we hear my clip?
And every day while slaves were being slaughtered or carted away across the waves, our Hamilton kept his guard up. Inside, he was longing for something to be a part of. The brother was ready to beg, steal, borrow, or barter.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda of In the Heights. This was recorded at the White House about 6 years ago.
Connected it to his brain, and he wrote his first refrain, a testament to his pain. Well, the word got around, they said, this kid is insane, man. Took up a collection just to send him to the mainland. Get your education, don't forget from whence you came, and the world is gonna know your name. What's your name, man?
Alexander Hamilton. His name is Alexander Hamilton.
And at this time, he thought that this project was, he was referring to it as the Hamilton mixtape. This was going to be his concept rap album based on Ron Chernow's exhaustive biography of Alexander Hamilton, which is now a musical. And it's great. You know, it actually feels immediate and fresh and urgent. You have actors of color playing all the founding fathers of the countries. There's hardly a white person in this, primarily about the rivalry between Hamilton and Aaron Burr, who eventually kills him in a duel in 1804.
Spoiler.
Yeah, sorry. That's
history spoiler.
Yeah, you should still see the show. And it's going to be a hot ticket for a while, but I think you will have plenty of chances. I really feel like this is a musical that is going to have a long afterlife that'll tour, I've heard that the Roots are actually producing the cast album.
Oh, wow.
For when that comes out, a lot of hip hop, a lot of, you know, just contemporary R&B in the score. There's like almost nothing that feels sort of traditionally, you know, musical theatery about it. It's like really funny, really really fresh. It's in Hamilton. I totally dug it.
Nice. Thank you, Chris Klimek. Well, I have spent much of the last week either traveling or watching Mission Impossible or watching Wet Hot American Summer. So I don't have a ton of additional stuff to offer, but I did over the weekend get a chance, if you are in Washington, D.C., as we are, I went to the National Building Museum, where until September 7th, they have an exhibit called The Beach. And what the beach is a gigantic, like kind of blocked off space in the middle of the open area of the building museum. They filled it with plastic balls. So it is a giant, like Chuck E. Cheese style.
You didn't go in, did you?
I did go into the ball.
Did you get pink eye?
I have not, but though we made many, many jokes about pink eye, and one of the problems with having them all be these kind of opaque, translucent balls is you can see whatever has managed to smear onto them. Now we're underselling it, because it is an incredibly fun and silly thing, and I talk a lot about, you know, whose generation is being served and whose nostalgia is being served. I think anybody can relate to a good ball pit. I got into this line for the beach thinking it was going to be excruciating. And what happened is, you know, what gets tiring really quickly is swimming around in a big pit of plastic balls. So people cycle out of the beach pretty quickly. So just goofing around in a big pit full of plastic balls while everyone around you is either holding up a phone to take a selfie or fishing around for their lost cell phone. I like to think of it as a lake of phones with plastic balls on top. So the ball pit as part of the beach, an exhibit at the National Building Museum. Mm-hmm. All right, one other thing. It has been a while since we have gathered your suggestions for Pop Culture Happy Hour topics. We keep this gigantic master list of topics for the show. You know, sometimes, you know, a movie comes out, it's obvious that's what we're going to talk about, but we're always looking for kind of strange evergreen ideas, and we have gathered a lot of our best ideas for show topics over the years from Pop Culture Happy Hour listeners, and so we are asking you incredibly nice people to, if you've got ideas for things you'd like to hear us talk about on the show, for you to pitch in and give us your ideas. We'll have links put up on the Pop Culture Happy Hour Facebook page at facebook.com/PCHH and also on the Monkey See blog at npr.org/monkeysee. Look for Pop Culture Happy Hour. And that brings us to the end of Pop Culture Happy Hour. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow the show at NPRPCHH. You can follow me at I Dislike Steven, that's STEPHEN. You can follow Glenn Weldon at GHWeldon, that's WELDON. And you can follow Chris Klimek at CTKlimek, KLIMEK. And you can follow our very special guest, Linda Holmes, at NPR Monkey C. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy. You can follow our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, that's KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to now. Thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening, and we will see you back here next week.
Hello, Pop Culture Happy Hour listeners. Hey, why don't you try out NPR's Planet Money? It's full of funny, insightful stories about how the world works, like why we work so much, plus useful stuff like the messed up economics of drought and the psychology of a big red button. Find Planet Money now at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.